This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Under federal law, people convicted of crack cocaine offenses typically get 50% more prison time than powder cocaine offenders. Yesterday, the United States Sentencing Commission voted unanimously to narrow that disparity and do it retroactively. The decision could reduce sentences for as many as 19,500 convicts. The principal reason is fairness. The great majority of those convicted on crack cocaine charges are black, and more than 20 years after Congress passed a law that mandated harsh sentences, experts now say there's little difference between crack and powdered cocaine. Critics, including the Justice Department, argue that the decision could release a flood of hardened criminals. Others worry about the additional load on an already overburdened federal judiciary system. And another set of critics say the measure doesn't go nearly far enough. If you have personal experience with this issue as a cop, a prosecutor, or as a convict, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can tell us your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, how the FBI and the CIA changed to prevent the next attack on the United States, the terrorist watch. But first, crack cocaine sentencing. And we begin with Rodney White. He served 15 and a half years for distribution of crack cocaine, and he joins us now from the studios of member station WCVE in Richmond, Virginia. And it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Hi, Neil.
And what were you convicted of?
Conspiracy to sell crack cocaine, and heroin.
And those are that's a pretty serious charge.
Most definitely.
Yeah. And if on the three different drugs, did you get different sentences for the different three drugs?
No, all of them was run concurrent as far as my sentence for the drugs. But because the crack cocaine was involved, I got a much higher sentence, a much harsher sentence than had it just only been the powder cocaine. And basically, I never sold the crack cocaine to anyone. It was just something that was said in the case that we had crack cocaine. It was only a very small amount of crack cocaine that was actually determined by physical evidence. It was just based on some informants or people that testified and said, yes, I remember him having crack cocaine, and that's how we got such a harsh sentence.
And if it had just been the powdered cocaine and the heroin, what would that have been?
I probably would have gotten probably about a five-year sentence, not including a gun charge, which was also part of the mandatory minimum for me to get 60 months for a gun charge, which was, in fact, my first offense. I'm a first-time nonviolent drug offender. So I got an 18-year sentence because of that, and I also had other co-defendants who are still serving time who got 30-year sentences and didn't sell any more drugs than I did. But just the fact that people told on them and said they had larger amounts, they got much larger sentences.
Now, let's put this in context for some people. You went to prison in 1992. If it had just been the powdered cocaine, you would have gotten out when Bill Clinton was still president. Instead, you've missed his both terms and almost all of George Bush's two terms.
That's right. As a matter of fact, I actually went to prison in 1991. I was sentenced in 1992 and given that sentence. So, yes, I did lose a big chunk of my life due to that sentence, and I probably would have been out a lot sooner.
And you've missed a big chunk of your son's life, too.
Most definitely. I had a son who was born 3 months after I came to prison. And the first time I really actually got a chance to see him and hold him as a free man, he was 16 years old. 15 years old, actually.
And at what point did you consider the fairness of this?
I never thought of it as being fair. Now, let me say this, Neil. I sold drugs. I do not make any qualms about that. I didn't sell the amount of drugs that the government said that I sold, but I definitely sold drugs. So I don't have a problem going to prison and serving my time. But to do such a large amount of time, it was never fair.
Never fair.
Never fair. And it's still not fair.
And I assume you talked to other people who were in prison about their sentences.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I actually helped a person get out of prison who was doing a 32-year sentence for crack cocaine, and he ended up getting immediate release.
Now, people argue, I think, in the federal system, something over 80% of those serving time on crack cocaine charges are African-American. Do you think that race played a part in this?
Well, in theory, I don't think race played a part in it because they tried to put together a guideline that would fit everybody, but it does not. The discretion must go back to the judges. The mandatory minimums must be abolished totally in order for it to be fair. to start a clean slate. I will say this, it's akin to a child taking its first step. We celebrate that as saying this is a good first step, but we know as a parent that there are many more steps that child must take. So we celebrate a first step, but there are many more steps that need to be taken, and especially to get Congress to eliminate the mandatory minimums altogether. Then it would be fair. Let the judges decide.
And you were released earlier this year, so how are you doing on your transition back to, I guess what we laughingly call the real world?
I'm doing fantastic in the sense that I'm out now. I'm selling cars, so I'm a car salesman, which it fits me. I'm in sales, but I'm doing great. But the transition is hard. It's not an easy task to be gone for 15 and a half years and come back into society. I got on the internet for the first time, things like that, something that some people take for granted. When I went to prison, there was no internet, so I got out on the internet. So just to think about that chunk of time that you lose is tremendous.
Rodney White, thanks very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Neil.
Rodney White served 15 and a half years in prison after being convicted of distribution of crack cocaine, and heroin. He joined us from our member station, WCVE, in Richmond, Virginia. Joining us now is Douglas Berman, a professor of law at Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University. He's with us from the studios of WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
And I have to begin. There was a decision yesterday by the United States Sentencing Commission and a decision very much on this subject earlier this week by the United States Supreme Court. Do these two things have anything to do with each other?
Well, they're interconnected in somewhat complicated ways. They are independent decisions that technically deal with independent issues, but they, in some sense, all flow from a U.S. Supreme Court decision back in 2005, United States versus Booker, which for complicated reasons ended up changing the federal sentencing guidelines from mandatory rules into advisory rules. And I should pause at this point to pick up something that Rodney talked about. That itself is different from the mandatory minimum statutes that Congress has put in place and that remain mandatory. But the guidelines, which are layered on top of the statutes, had been converted to advisory in 2005. What exactly that meant had confounded lower courts, particularly against the backdrop of these crack powder differences, which the Sentencing Commission that wrote these guidelines has been saying for over a decade are unjustly long, the crack sentences. And so after the guidelines became advisory, lower courts struggled to figure out whether that meant they themselves could lower sentences based on crack offenses. And I think the commission felt that it needed to act to revise the guidelines to make them more equitable. Still not parity. All they've done is narrow the differences. But they realize now that the guidelines are advisory, it was incumbent upon the commission to make sure that the advice provided by the guidelines is more in keeping with their own research and their own sense of fairness.
Well, 20 years ago and more, the Congress passed those harsh minimum sentences for crack cocaine with the understanding, the belief at that time, that crack cocaine was an epidemic in a lot of American communities, that it prompted a great deal of violence and was much more addictive than powdered cocaine. That's the reason for there's a distinction in these sentencing guidelines.
That's right. And there's a tendency, and I don't think it's just in the context of drug sentencing, to react quite strongly to any seeming national problem. We obviously see this. You'll be talking about terrorism later in the show. We've seen this after some of the white-collar problems, the corporate crime, that Congress and state legislatures, too, often say, well, this is a problem. It's being unaddressed under current law. We need to get extra, extra tough. The problem is the sort of momentary crises usually aren't nearly as bad when you look back in history. And that's what the Sentencing Commission itself has been saying for over a decade, that the assumptions and perceptions that drove Congress to enact these extraordinarily harsh crack sentences really didn't pan out, and that ultimately became much more an issue of fairness than even sensible and needed harsh sentences for serious crimes.
Now, the Supreme Court decision earlier this week said judges could use discretion to issue lower sentences than those apparently required under the guidelines. And the U.S. Sentencing Commission yesterday said this could apply retroactively, their decision to reduce the sentences for crack cocaine crimes. But by what, 17% on average? That would be, it depends on how long you're serving, but it could seem like not a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's a relatively small tweak, but the attention and controversy that the decision has generated, especially with respect to retroactivity, I think is revealing a couple things. One, the numbers you quoted before, that there are 19,500 currently imprisoned defendants who might benefit from this 17% reduction, just shows how long the sentences have been. There's roughly speaking only about 4,000 or 5,000 crack sentences imposed each year, but because these sentences have been so long, there are stacked up so many defendants who have been serving, you know, not just years but decades. And for them, a 17% reduction obviously will make a difference. It's often said in the defense arena, the difference between 15 years and 20 years doesn't seem like a lot until you're in your 15th year. And so this is a setting in which even a small change could have a dramatic impact on the lives of people, you know, like Rodney and others who may be able to get out a little bit earlier.
And
in addition, though, I think it also highlights that even small changes that benefit criminal defendants get subject to lots of controversy, even if everybody agrees that the old sentences were unfair. If you don't take seriously remedying these past injustices, it's very easy to look at the Sentencing Commission's decision to make these new guidelines retroactive as a decision essentially to cut a break to a bunch of people previously sentenced for serious crimes.
And quickly, guidelines would take effect, the Sentencing Commission's recommendations would take effect in March. That gives Congress a chance to act on this if they want to.
That's correct. And I think another part of the story was that a Democratic Congress has indicated much more of an interest to take further steps to remedy the past injustices. At least my instinct is they won't overrule what the commission did here, again, in part because it's a relatively modest change.
Stay with us, if you would. Douglas Berman, law professor at the Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University. We're talking about the change in sentencing guidelines for crack cocaine. Up next, arguments on both sides of the issue. We'll hear from a United States attorney and from a member of the Sentencing Commission that voted yesterday. Also, we'll take your calls, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later in the hour, Ronald Kessler on the desperate race to stop the next attack. His new book is called The Terrorist Watch. Right now, we're talking about yesterday's decision by the U.S. Sentencing Commission that could retroactively reduce prison terms for thousands of people convicted of crimes related to crack cocaine. Douglas Berman is our guest. He's a law professor at the Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University. If you have personal experience with this issue, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And tell us your stories on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We're going to hear two views on this. And first, Gretchen Chappert. She's a U.S. attorney for the Western District of North Carolina and joins us by phone from an office at the Justice Department here in Washington, D.C. It's very good of you to take the time to speak with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
And yesterday, the Attorney General, Mr. Mukasey, came out and said he's opposed to this. What's the reason behind this? Why is the Justice Department opposed to the Commission's decision?
Well, for several reasons. First of all, we are talking about 19,500 cases that are eligible for resentencing. That's 19,500 defendants who will be coming back for reconsideration of their sentences. And the numbers represent fully 10% of the entire federal criminal population. When you talk about how much sentence reduction this is likely to be, it's likely to be an average of 27 months. The impact on the court system is going to be profound. The impact on fragile communities will be much more significant. Our concerns are a number of things. First of all, the people whose sentences are going to be cut, the majority of them, or excuse me, I should say 23% of them, will be eligible for release within the first year. These individuals will not have completed the typical reentry programs with the Bureau of Prisons. For example, the Bureau of Prisons figures it takes 30 months to prepare someone to return to their community with 450 hours of training in six core areas, frequently community confinement and halfway houses. For these individuals, a lot of them will not have the advantages of that kind of transition. Many of these individuals will be returning to fragile, low economic communities that we are trying to help stand up and improve life in those communities. We will be returning people to those communities who have not had the kind of preparation that they need to be reentered into those communities. And it's important, Neil, to remember that this particular population in the Bureau of Prisons has a high recidivism rate based upon the criminal histories for these individuals and the fact that many of them carried firearms and had aggravated roles for their offenses.
Well, a federal judge would review
these
decisions. And let me point out, the Sentencing Commission, which is bipartisan, voted unanimously to approve this. The Supreme Court in its decision was 7-2, which is pretty strong for the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court decision does not have anything to do with the retroactivity of the
I understand that, but it touches on the fairness issue, which is at the heart of the Sentencing Commission's decision.
The point, the Supreme Court decision said in Kimbrough that the district court did not abuse its discretion, that it upheld the discretion of the district court. The big concern we have in the Department of Justice is how these individuals will impact their communities. In terms of fairness, we're concerned about fairness to fragile communities. We're concerned about the impact that we're going to have of people with significant criminal histories and frequently violent pasts coming back into communities that are already fragile.
Well, let's get a caller in on this conversation. And Fred is with us. Fred calling from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, I was just hoping that you would consider that maybe the reason there never was this tremendous surge of crime related to crack is because of the harsh sentencing. Could you consider that?
Oh, absolutely. I personally believe that one reason that, for example, we read in the paper today that drug use is down in America is because of education and deterrence in the court system and by law enforcement. We know that when there are stiff penalties, that it is a deterrent and that that's one of the most effective means of dealing with violent crime, and that's our concern.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Fred, thanks for the call. But the other part of that is if the experts say there's now determined in the fair light of 20 years experience, not a whole lot of difference between crack cocaine and powdered cocaine.
Well, I guess I am an expert. I tell you, I was an assistant public defender. I'm an expert in terms of real world experience. I was an assistant public defender when crack cocaine hit Charlotte, North Carolina. And I saw the criminal picture change in a period of just over 2 years when we switched from powder to crack. Crack is clearly associated with more violent crime. I've heard it said, and I believe it's true, that cocaine destroys an individual. Crack destroys a community. I was interested when you talked to Rodney earlier on your program that Rodney acknowledged that in addition to being involved in a drug conspiracy, that he was also convicted for carrying a firearm in relation to that crime, which is typically what we see with a lot of the crack offenders.
Let's get another caller in, and this is Adam. Adam with us from Salt Lake City.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I really don't mean any disrespect towards the district attorney, but I'm just because there's a correlation between crack and violence is obviously not causal, but I wanted to speak really to the fact that returning this discretion back to the judges won't necessarily increase the fairness, because studies have already shown that white men are 3 times more likely to be acquitted of the same crimes as black men, and so the discretion part isn't going to reduce the racism. However, making better parity, a better ratio of crack to cocaine being the fair, would actually make it more fair. Mandatory sentencing is fine as long as the crimes are prosecuted the same. And I wanted to ask, if the recidivism rates are so high already, why would we already be so worried about letting criminals out early without going through the programs if the programs aren't working as it is?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, let me emphasize that we don't prosecute by race or gender or any of those factors. We prosecute based on conduct. And secondly, I would note that if you are allowing people back into the communities before they've had the benefit of any sort of reentry program, you exacerbate the likelihood that they will recidivate.
Thanks very much for the call. As you look ahead on this question, what political action can the Justice Department do to try to have Congress resist this decision?
Well, if the Congress wishes to change this, the Congress can enact legislation, and that is the role of the Congress. In the Department of Justice, our role is to enforce the law. The Sentencing Commission has spoken, and until the law changes, my job as a prosecutor is to follow the law as it currently exists.
You know that the commission came out strongly saying, look, this is not a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yes.
These sentences will, even if they're going to be reduced, a federal judge would look at this and say, well, this criminal is clearly involved in violence and not eligible, or this person, first-time offender, not violent, maybe they are eligible.
Well, and here are some of the problems. We are going to be reopening, and again, these are legitimate, credible convictions. We are going to have to reopen cases. If the courts decide to have full-blown hearings of one variety or another, 19,500 people may need to be returned to their respective districts from all over the country for hearings in cases where files have been closed, Files will need to be recovered from archives. Defense attorneys would need to be appointed. Witnesses may no longer be available. There are a lot of challenges associated with reopening this number of cases. But again, my primary concern is that there are some judges in the country who will release some of these individuals, and because of the impact on these communities, the fairness will not redound to those who actually live in the communities where these people will be returning.
Gretchen Shepherd, again, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Gretchen Shepherd, U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, with us by phone from the Justice Department here in Washington, D.C. Well, let's turn now to John R. Steer, Vice Chair and Commissioner of the United States Sentencing Commission, which made the decision yesterday. He's with us by phone from his office also in Washington, D.C. Nice to have you on the program.
Well, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
And I was wondering if you would respond to the U.S. Attorney's complaints about this decision. Are you going to be returning thousands of people back to fragile communities?
Well, you know, every one of these persons who is able to convince a judge that they are entitled to a reduction by their the nature of the criteria, eventually would be released and coming back to the community anyway. This simply says that the sentences for those offenders, if the judge decides to release them, will basically be in line with sentences for persons who are convicted after November 1st, which was the date of the amendment that reduced prospectively going forward the sentences for crack offenders.
And what about the concern of a lot of clogging up of an already overburdened federal judiciary?
Well, you know, we got a lot of good advice on this point. The federal judiciary, the federal probation officers, all told us that they believe they can handle that. There is, while there is something of a surge at initially, these persons, if they're released early, will be released over a period of 30 years. You know, it's there is an initial surge, and then it begins to decrease thereafter. So the federal judges have said they believe it's the right thing to do, and they think that the system can handle it. And I think that went a long way in helping us to convince the Sentencing Commission that it should allow this to happen.
And the point that the U.S. attorney also made, that in her experience, crack cocaine did incur more violent crime. Who did you listen to in the evidence that said crack cocaine and powdered cocaine were more similar than different?
Well, the commission for some period of time, since 1995, has felt that crack cocaine, while it may be somewhat more dangerous and more of a problem to society, the penalties did not warrant the differential that was hurriedly enacted in 1986 and followed by the Sentencing Commission at that time when the guidelines were first written. The evidence does show, I think, that statistically speaking, crack offenders are somewhat more associated with guns and violence than powder cocaine offenders. But still, that is only a minority of the total number of crack offenders. And there are separate federal crimes and federal penalties that can address this violence, and also enhancements in the federal guidelines that will continue in the future to also address some of these factors.
Also, the U.S. attorney said race plays no part in who they decide to prosecute. How much did race play in your decision yesterday?
Well, I think in the back of every commissioner's mind, there is a perception of how this is viewed as a racially disparate and a racially discriminatory and unfair penalty scheme. But I think when you got right down to it, certainly commissioners were trying to base their decision on entirely lawful and legitimate differences, and it's not a decision that I think is driven by race, simply an awareness of the way that this is perceived and a desire that by narrowing the penalties, hopefully we will improve the confidence of everyone in the federal criminal justice system.
And finally, those of us used to partisan politics here in Washington, D.C., have become unaccustomed in recent years to unanimous decisions from bipartisan panels. How important is it that this was a unanimous 7-0 decision?
Well, I think it's very important, and I think what does send the signal that the commission has gone through a very careful deliberative process over a period of months. We received over 33,000 public comments, and while I can't say that we read every one of them, we read a heavy dose of them, and we had a public hearing. We heard from a number of witnesses on both sides of the issue. The Justice Department through Ms. Safford testified, and I think gave very weighty testimony. It's just that on balance, when you stack up the equities against the public safety concerns, the equities are very strong here, and there are ways to address some of the public safety concerns. In fact, before the commission even voted to make the amendment retroactive, the first thing it did was strengthen the policy guidance that is available and that federal judges are required to consider before they make a retroactive decision. And we said, front and center, judges must consider public safety. Some of these persons are not should not be rewarded with any reduction in sentence. And others, if they're granted a reduction, the decision might be accompanied by some modifications in their conditions of supervised release to ease their transition back into the community and make sure that the public is adequately protected. I agree with the U.S. Attorney. That is very, very important.
John Steer, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
John Steer, a vice chair and commissioner of the United States Sentencing Commission. We're talking about the decision to reduce somewhat the sentences of those convicted on crack cocaine charges in the federal court system. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And still with us, Douglas Berman, a law professor at the Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Stacy. Stacy calling us from Hartford, Connecticut.
Hello, Neil.
Go ahead, please.
All right. How you doing? Just in regards, I just did a 5-year sentence for crack conspiracy to sell and possession of crack cocaine. I'm a first-time offender, and I have 4 years of probation. Now, the question that I have for the USDA is, she mentioned the fact that, people need to go through a whole process in order for them to be reacclimated into society and whatnot. And I actually did 6 months in a halfway house. And, I mean, I have a lot of associates and people that I've met while doing time that do have a problem with recidivism. But the problem that I personally had is it was my first time offense, and I got hit with 5 years for a mandatory minimum sentence for doing the possession of crack cocaine and distribution. And the way it was done, and this is the problem that I have with the setup with the whole mandatory minimum thing, is if someone is falsely convicted of some crime that determines that they deserve a death sentence and whatnot, and we find out that they're innocent, does that not does that not make a point of the fact that, there's a problem with our death sentence policy? And that's the same thing I'm saying in regard to the crack sentencing guidelines. Mm. I mean, if someone has a first-time offense and or was entrapped to commit that particular crime and you find that the sentencing guidelines are overly harsh, is that not a problem? I mean, isn't that reason enough to say that, look, maybe these guidelines are not accurate because we're sitting here sentencing people who are first-time offenders and or have been entrapped through certain
Well, without getting into the entrapment issue, which is another subject for another day, but Douglas Berman, how many people like Stacy would have been implicated in the system who are first-time offenders who are getting these long sentences?
A large number, although one of the concerns is that these amendments that are made retroactive won't speak, as I mentioned before, to the statutory mandatory minimums. And so as much excitement as there may be for a lot of offenders for the chance to get the benefit of these more fair rules, there are still limitations on it. And that's why I think, as you mentioned at the outset, everybody may be looking to Congress. The Department of Justice may hope Congress overrules what the commission did. I know there are a lot of people who have been working for justice on these issues who are hopeful and eager to have Congress go further and undo these mandatory minimums. And in addition, and I think this is an important point, the reentry concerns that the department is highlighting is not just a concern for these offenders. Nationwide, something in the neighborhood of 700,000, I should say that number again, 700,000 offenders are being released from state jails or federal jails and prisons every year. And there's a bipartisan understanding that reentry services are critical to try to reduce our recidivism rates. There's been an act in Congress that's been kicking around for a couple years called the Second Chance Act, which if the Department of Justice was as concerned as they say about reentry, they'd get behind and try to make sure it got enacted before they worry about this smaller group of offenders getting more equal sentences.
Doug Berman, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Douglas Berman, professor of law at the Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University, with us from member station WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. Up next, Ron Kessler details his changes at the FBI and the CIA since 9/11. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.